Hi, everybody, and welcome to a special podcast from Popdose. I'm Dave Lifton, and we are here today to talk about Bruce Springsteen's new album, High Hopes. I wanted to do this show because when the disc was announced, there was a lot of head-scratching from a lot of us who are Bruce fans. He's kind of known as a creature of habit, and what we heard about this, you know, the album, it seemed like the album took him out of his usual way of doing things. So I thought it would be a good idea to discuss it with a few of my friends, and I reached out to the very good people at Blogness on the Edge of Town, which is a great Springsteen site, and they're here to join me. So let's welcome the founder of the site, Pete Cianca, as well, who's also, by the way, written for Popdose in the past, although not recently.
The distant past.
As well as Deborah Filsman and Anne Haynes. How's it going, everybody?
Good. How are you?
Good. All right.
I am doing well, thanks, now that we've gotten all these technical issues out of the way.
What technical issues?
I don't know what you mean.
Okay. Well, let's start with our overall thoughts on the album. I reviewed this on Popdose a few days after the leak came out. So the big question is, what y'all think of my review?
Oh, I'm sorry. Was there?
Wait, you wrote a review?
I shat some things out.
It was a fine, fine piece of writing. I don't remember a word of it, but It really stuck with me at the time and hit the nail right on the head. That's all I got.
Well, what was that? I said that as a joke. Y'all realize that?
There was furious nodding.
Yes, yes, because furious nodding comes over great over Skype.
So, but I've read a ton of reviews at this point, and I don't think I've read any two that agree. Which is what's really fascinating me about this album is that the response has been so incredibly mixed. I think every single song I've seen somebody single it out as the best one, and every single song I've seen somebody single it out as the worst one.
Well, except for David Frick, who just loved every second of it.
But he only gave it 3.5 or 4.5 stars, so,
that's,
you know,
a pan for Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
But there's been 47 articles, so.
Yeah, I thought we were going to be discussing Bruce Springsteen's 25 Greatest Heroes. That's not what this is about.
That's scheduled for tomorrow. Block it out.
No, I mean, my thoughts, you know, it's what's really surprising to me is how, you know, how you take this album seems to almost completely depend on your perspective on Bruce Springsteen as an artist. You know, if you're measuring everything he puts out in comparison to his past work and measuring it, you know, by whether or not it holds up favorably to that work, you might not love this album that much. If you're eager to see him, you know, take different avenues and do some things differently and follow his muse, Tom Morello, or whoever that may be, you know, wherever it may go, and then see what comes out of it, then I think, you know, you might take this a little better. But, you know, where you're coming from seems to almost, you know, like I said, it dictates sort of what you think of it, you know, more so than what's actually on the album.
I think as Pete, you've pointed out before, you just reach a point in your career, if you're someone like Springsteen, where you're not competing against other artists, you're competing against yourself. And that's sort of, on the one hand, a great position to be in, but also pretty tough.
I mean, you're competing with the dude who put out Born to Run, Darkness on the Edge of Town. I mean, that's hardly fair, even to Bruce.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, is he competing with it? I mean, he's only competing with it in the eyes of his public. No, I mean, I like what Pete is saying about how he's not the same person that he was even 15 years ago, no less 40 years ago. So you can't expect that same type of... There are only two bands, when you think about it, that ever not brew and stayed good, and that's the Ramones and AC/DC. You know? I remember reading an interview with, I think it was Angus Young, and he said that their idea of artistic growth was that one song they wrote in E. It's one of my favorite quotes about anybody, that anybody said about their career. Yeah, I mean, he has grown, he has changed as a songwriter. As I've noticed since The Rising, he has become what I think is a lot more, for lack of a better term, self-consciously poetic. There's a lot more imagery and allegory, and sometimes that works, and sometimes I don't always know what he's saying anymore. You know, I'm not, granted, and I'm not as big a poetry person as you are, so a lot of that stuff escapes me. So, you know, it just kind of flies over my head. And so it's like I hear something like Hunter of Invisible Game, and I'm like, okay, this is a pretty tune. It's a nice little waltz. He doesn't work in waltz time a lot, but I kind of don't get it.
And I've never glommed onto that song yet. I think at some point it will hit me, and I'll be like, oh, man, that's a great song. But I think for me, it is the waltz time that throws me, and I think it's just a personal thing. I was possibly scarred by having to learn to waltz in a preschool gym class. I cannot get past the 3-4 time. It's like a hard iambic pentameter rhyme kind of thing. I can't get past that, and I'm sure at some point I will, probably when I hear it live. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but how did you feel about the Seeger Sessions band's recasting of If I Should Fall Behind?
Yeah.
Oh, it was okay. I liked it
but
a lot.
Again, it didn't thrill me. Yeah.
I mean, I like Hunter of Invisible Game, even if it doesn't exactly trip off the tongue.
I keep on getting it confused with the old Smokey Robinson song, Hunter Gets Captured by the Game.
Right. Oh, well, see, Bruce is a Smokey fan, no doubt. But, you know, I think the song, it sort of had a Kingdom of Days feeling to me, you know, about sort of this, you know, about, you know, a crazy world, but mature love, you know, can sort of, you know, pull you from that. And, you know, I just like the tone of it. I like the language, you know, for some reason it spoke to me.
Except it's a bit more haunting.
Yeah. I mean, it's because of the allegory. I mean, it's a different approach.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I think, you know, the question is, do you like plain-spoken old Bruce or sort of poetic new Bruce? You know, it's two different, you know, sort right. of approaches to songwriting.
Mm-hmm. You mean plain-spoken like Mad Men, drummers, bummers, teenage diplomats,
you know,
and
you know,
all that?
You know what I mean? Like, I believe in the promised land, that kind of plain-spoken, that type of thing.
I'll counter your Blinded by the Light with Ooh, Ooh, I Got a Crush on You, okay? Which, raise your hand if you've ever seen Crush on You live. Haha, I got y'all beat.
You seen Incident yet, Dave? I was wondering if...
Yeah.
Fuck you. Fuck you.
Nor have I. I can commiserate.
Thanks, Pete.
I did.
I did, too.
Yeah.
Must be a girl thing. So, yeah, so, but back to, I think, Pete, were you the one that said something about, the
right.
mature love
right.
whole kind of Kingdom of Days thing? And that's, I think that's a useful comparison for this song, because I think he's working, sort of minding the same vein, although I think Hunter is a little bit darker. I mean, I think Kingdom of Days is sort of a, hey, growing old is actually quite mm-hmm. nice kind of a thing, and Hunter of Invisible Game, not so much. Because you don't see it as being a real success. I mean, it's invisible. How are you going to catch it or even know that you did if you did?
Yeah.
You know,
and that's why, I mean, it's a different song. And, you know, it's nice that he's minding some of the same themes without repeating himself.
And too much happiness.
Through the boneyard, rattling black smoke, we rolled on. Down into the valley where the beast has its throne. I sing my song in the sharp of my blade. I am the hunter of invisible game.
I think the, you know, the thing I wanted to mention about this release is, I think what bothers me is, you know, if that's the word, is that we know so many of these songs, or a certain, you know, at least a number of these songs so well from official releases in the past, not, you know, muddy bootlegs or YouTube videos, you know, which you would place The Wall in that category. But, you know, you have these other ones that, you know, you could go and buy them on iTunes, and we all did, because we're in that strata of fan that's going to buy everything he puts out, right? So it's weird to get a new album and be so intimately familiar. You know, even the arrangements are pretty much the same. If he wanted my advice, he's not asking for it, but if I was going to give it to him, I would say, you know, if you think you might want to put this on an album down the road, you know, don't release it. Don't release that live version. Let people dig it up wherever they're going to dig it up. You know, and I think... You know, then this album would have more impact.
American Skin got an official release on Live in New York City. So did the Electric Tom Joad. So this is actually the third Tom Joad that we're getting.
Exactly. See, on that one, I'm okay with it, though.
I mean, you know, well, I don't mind it, but, you know, I might rather see something else there that I hadn't heard before.
Right.
I think, you know, there's a certain strata of fans sort of that's maybe not as diehard as we are, that is not as familiar, certainly with the Dream Baby Dream, which I feel like, you know, didn't have the same, you know, sort of level of attention as An American Skin, which got a lot of headlines, and I think in that live album was obviously very popular.
I don't have a problem with him, you know, taking, you know, saying, okay, I'm going to do something, even if it's redundant to the few thousand people, the very small percentage of our fan base who are on the internet downloading bootlegs all the time. I'm fine with that. I don't really have a problem with putting that, but it is more like American Skin and Ghost of Tom Joad, which had already been released in these arrangements, with the exception of Morello's guitar, really. You know, that's not the problem to me. But yes, at the same time, because I am in that category, and we are in that category, it really seems more like an EP, because we're only getting six songs that we've never heard before, whereas we're used to getting about 12 to 15 new songs that we can dissect and analyze, and here it's, you know, it's really only like that middle section, but from Down in the Hole to Hunter of Invisible Game. I was listening to it this morning, and I got to Hunter of Invisible Game, and I'm like, oh, this is the last song. You know, it just seemed like the last song, even though I had three others to go. You know, I accept that that's something that's only going to affect a handful of us in comparison to the number of people who were buying this.
Well, how do you feel about the fact that, you know, it's bookended with covers?
I don't mind the covers. I mean, I love Dream Baby Dream. I remember seeing it in 2005 and, you know, just my jaw dropping. I like High Hopes a lot. I like, you know, I very much like what the Horns are doing. I like what Morello's doing. So it doesn't bother me, but I'm not hearing a new song. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, regardless. I mean, if I was hearing it for the first time with fresh ears, I would say, wow, this is really good. But I have known High Hopes for 18 years. I have known Dream Baby Dream for 8 years.
Yeah, I'm surprised that the covers don't bother me, because I love his writing. I mean, I love him as a writer as much as anything. And to me, High Hopes is as live as the E Street Band has ever sounded in the studio. Yep. And that is so great that I could get past almost anything just for that live. It's probably the most live they've sounded in the studio since The River to me.
Yes, that is.
And for that, I mean, I could forgive any number of sins for that.
Right. There, I think really since when Steve left, because Born in the USA has a lot of live recording on it. It's just that synth sound and the drum sound, the drum samples that they put on there, really kind of change it around. But there is a lot of live recording on it. You could kind of hear that, like in I'm Going Down and stuff. That and Just Like Firewood and Frankie Fell in Love are my three favorites. High Hopes, as we're talking about, are my favorite songs on the album because they sound live.
I should mention too, we did a poll asking people which track they skip most, and it looks like Just Like Firewood is the most popular song, or tied with Frankie Fell in Love for the most popular song if you rate it by the, you know, least skipped. So people, you know, so people who are coming to our blog at least don't seem to have an issue with it.
And I think what that tells us is that, not that they're the favorite songs, but that they're sort of the middle ground songs. Because I think the rest of them people either love or hate. And I think those two songs people are like, oh, okay, that's okay. That's pretty good. Although I love Frankie Fell in Love. I cannot wait to hear that song live.
I keep waking up with that in my head.
If he's going to do that song live, he's going to have to bring it down a step and a half. At least a step and a half. He's got it capoed. He's going to have to remove the capo, because there is no way on earth his voice is going to hold out on that song for a whole tour. Just listen to any live version of Out in the Street that's been recorded towards the end of the tour lately, and you'll hear exactly what happens to Bruce's voice when he tries to hit those notes. late in the tour. You know, it. I mean, I think it's a great song. It when I first heard it, what I was hearing in it was Bill Janovitz on his last album, just kind of like that quasi folk rock Stones thing that Bill Janovitz did so good on his last album, and in the chorus, just that and the harmony was very much like Buffalo Tom to me.
Mm-hmm. I can hear that.
Well, and there definitely is a Stonesy thing going on there, which I love when they go into that mode, when the right. band is in that kind of Stones-ish mode.
But talking about the live sound, that brings us to what I think is the main problem with it, and that is Ron Aniello's production. You know, some of the things that he brought don't even make sense. You know, like there's that moment in Down in the Hole where they removed the vocal effect in mid-verse.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little odd.
That was jarring.
Yeah, and it detracts from the song.
To me, what it does, and I'm going to play devil's advocate a bit here. I think that song, it could be a very beautiful song. It could be almost a soothing song. And I think that moment, and I think the children's chorus, which I know really bothers some people, I think there are just some things that are in there just to make the song a little more disturbing and disquieting and just jar you out of this is a beautiful song into, wait, this is not a comfortable place.
I'll buy that. You sold me.
Well, I'm not saying it necessarily works, but I do think that that's a song that walks a line between being very disquieting and extremely beautiful.
Like much of The Rising, if you think
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the song doesn't successfully transcend the fact that it is from The Rising, that is its context. I mean,
more than any other song on here, mm-hmm. it feels like it, you know, belongs elsewhere for that reason.
Mm-hmm. It is of that time. It is of that place. I mean, there's other songs like The Wall. It's about Vietnam and so on, but it transcends its setting in a way that I think Down in the Hole doesn't transcend its setting. And I'm saying that even though it's one of my favorite songs on the album, just because it's so haunting.
Mm-hmm. The Wall just kills me every time. Oh, God. When I get to that Robert McNamara line, I just...
That's one of my favorite lines mm-hmm. on the entire album.
Yeah, that's the instant classic, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that song is killer. Absolute killer.
Yeah. The line, for those of you who haven't heard the album, is I bet I heard Robert McNamara said he's sorry when he's staring at the name of his deceased friend on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C.
Understated and quiet and...
Yeah.
And he sings it without drama.
Yeah.
Right. There's a resolve there more than anger. It's really effective.
It's just very, I mean, that song kind of snuck in on me. About mm-hmm. halfway through the song, I'm just, well, the first time I listened to the album, okay, I'm in a plane. I'm at 30,000 feet listening to it through earbuds because that was where I was. And it just sucked the air out of the place about mm-hmm. halfway through. I was, oh, man.
Yeah, and it's continuing to have that effect, though. I thought that would wear off after a few listens, but every time I hit that, it just, I need to kind of take a moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was listening to it at work the other day, and I had to stop what I was doing and just mm-hmm. be in the song. And I've listened to it probably 2-3 dozen times at this point.
Sure.
And I still, when I hear it, I have to stop and be in that song. And that, yeah. mm-hmm. to me, says something.
Yeah, I've tried to do that to be on the bus and checking Twitter, and really it is on that Robert McNamara line that I just kind of like stop what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Cigarettes and a bottle of beer. This poem that I wrote for you. This black stone and these hot tears are all I got left now of you. I remember you in the Marine uniform laughing, living at your Chappelle party. I read Robert McNamara, says he's sorry. Your high boots and striped t-shirt, I believe you looked so bad. Hey, you and your rock and roll band, you were the best thing this shit town ever had. Now the men will put you here, eat with their families in rich dining halls. An apology and forgiveness got no place here at all. Here at the wall.
Two songs I wanted to talk about. One is Heaven's Wall, which I'm not crazy about. I think, you know, a lot of people seem to like it more than I do. And This Is Your Sword, which I actually like very much. And seems to be one of the least popular, just in terms of the commentary I've seen. So I'll throw that out to the panel. What do you guys think?
Heaven's Wall, I haven't gotten into yet. I think it's a really rousing song. And I think both of those, as I wrote, are going to sound really good live. Mm-hmm. They'll be just really good for getting the crowd up. And you know how Bruce puts songs in certain spots based on what he wants the audience to do, most famously Waiting on a Sunny Day.
No yep. comment.
Right. Well, I think that was a comment in and of itself. And Heaven's Wall and This Is Your Sword will have that effect. He will want everybody to raise their hands in the same way that they do with Lonesome Day, you know, and everybody sing along and stuff. I think it goes on a little long, and I'm not really sure how that will translate live. He may even want to draw it out even more, like he did with Mary's Place for so long.
I actually see This Is Your Sword as being the Mary's Place that's going to turn into a big American Land extravaganza.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah, I'm not really a fan of that song, but I think it is sonically the best of the up-tempo material on the album. It is going to sound great, much mm-hmm. in the same way that Shackled and Drawn took on this whole other life.
Yeah.
Right.
On the last tour. Mm. I can hear that, This Is Your Sword, going into Badlands.
Mm.
It just has that, okay, we're going to take it to this point, and now we're going to hit you with Badlands to take it higher.
End of main set.
Yeah. I could see both of these working very well, although I always try to hesitate to go there in a discussion about an album, because a lot of people will never see it live, you mm-hmm. know, and it has to sort of, you know, stand or fall on its own merits on the, you know, on the album. And I think the problem I had with Heaven's Wall is he's done a lot of these songs, I'm far from the only one to say this, but, you know, with these biblical allegories, and I feel like when he's done it recently, it's had more context to it. Like Rocky Ground felt like it was mm-hmm. it was based in somebody's real life, and maybe that's the rap verse or the context of the album as a whole. And even I'll Work for Your Love, which, you know, you have the character in the bar, and there's a romance to it, and you know, it felt more grounded. Whereas This Is Here is a bunch of biblical stuff, you know, and it's gonna sound great, and you know, I just didn't feel anything there.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Rocky Ground, the first time I heard it, I immediately went to things in my own life and things that make me feel that way, and hooked right into it, and it gave me goosebumps from the very first time I listened to it. And yep. Heaven's Wall, I think you're right, that it doesn't have that same personal kind of thing. It's about raise your hand, raise your hand, raise your hand. That's what the song's about.
And it's such a shame that title was taken.
And on This Is Your Sword, I'm just a sucker for songs that sound like fatherly advice. I for whatever reason, they get me. And that's sort of how I felt this one. But I think you're right. It is. I mean, they're certainly going to take on a different life, you know, in concert, which we'll find out if he ever comes back to the United States.
Don't get people started, Pete.
Well, all right, let's put that to rest, because if you did see the news about him possibly offering downloads of every show, they did say it would start with the next leg. So
that would be South Africa, right?
No, after South Africa.
Oh, after that one. Oh.
Yes, he did specify. Granted, the next leg could be Europe, but...
Yeah. But that also opens up the live experience to people who may not otherwise have the opportunity. So how the songs work live becomes maybe more of a point. And I think Heaven's Wall was written for the live experience. I feel very strongly that he wrote that thinking, this is going to be great. He's writing for this version of the band, which is something new. He's writing for the singers and the horns and the expanded East Street band and minor outlying territories that he's got on that stage now. He's writing for 18 people.
Well, do we know when that song dates from? We don't know. I mean, obviously we know that Down in the Hole was from The Rising. He said the bulk of the songs came from 2002 to 2008.
Something he said in a couple of interviews is that he thinks, yeah, I'm going to put these on the album because I think this is something the fans would like to have. In the SiriusXM interview, he talked a little bit about, you know, how the songs are going to be live and thinking about what the band's going to do with them. And that actually kind of bothers me a little bit. I don't want him to be writing things or putting out things because he thinks the fans would like them. I want him to follow his own muse and maybe challenge us a little bit more. I don't know. Well, what do you guys think about that?
Maybe Tom Morello liked them, so he followed them.
Yeah.
Whatever Tom wants, Tom gets.
Yeah, well, I think that brings into the question of Morello. I think we all agree that he's kind of the star of the record.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm worried that if he stays with the band, Bruce is going to become too reliant on him, and it'll further marginalize Nils and Steve.
I think that's already happening.
Yeah, and to say nothing of, you know, Roy.
Sure.
I think, I mean, I know he's going to take part in this coming tour, but I don't know. Something tells me that's going to be it. I think, you know, he's already announced his first solo album, and I don't know. I just have a feeling this is Tom's last hurrah with the E Street Band. I don't know why I'm saying that, but I just get a sense.
Yeah, I get that sense too. He's a guest star on this tour, and I mean, I love him. I'm looking forward to seeing him. But I agree, it's maybe one too many guitar players. Although you have to admit, Steve Van Zandt is doing his part for guitar player employment in the E Street Band. He quit the band, they brought in Nils. Nils never left.
Yeah.
He left to do Lilyhammer. They bring in Tom.
Yeah.
Is he ever going to leave?
And don't forget, Patty also plays acoustic. And Patty also replaced Steve.
That's right. And, you know, more guitar. So, yeah go Steve Van Zandt. The guitar union is going to be paying him off.
So basically what you're saying, by 2025, I could be playing guitar in the E Street Band?
Nice.
Well, it just depends on how much time Steve has to take off for Lilyhammer and how desperate Bruce gets. But I do agree. I don't see Morello as being a permanent addition to the band. I think, you know, this is our chance to see him and enjoy this variation on what the band does and what they can sound like.
As long as he learns how to play Detroit medley.
Yeah. You never heard of that. God.
Yeah.
I predict that song shows up in the very first set list.
Right.
I predict yeah.
And I should say, I also like what he does on this album. I don't think he detracts. I did find it a little odd that it was the Tom Joad was so, you know, it was basically a studio recreation of what he was doing on stage for the live version, which seemed, you know, I think one of the writers from Britain, I forget which one, talked about how it, I think he used the word ludicrous. He said it was ludicrous in a studio setting. I wouldn't go that far. But I thought it may be, you know, I would have liked to see him do something different. Understated is probably not a word to use in terms of what I would like to, you know, because that just wasn't going to happen.
Well, there were a couple of spots, like his guitar playing on Harry's Place is not what you would expect, you know, what we hear from Morello. He's doing some very nice colors with the wah-wah pedal and stuff. He's not just going over the top on the solo. He's showing his versatility there.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And something I noticed the one and only time I've ever seen the band with Morello was at Wrigley Field. And I was surprised that he did hang out on stage and play a few of the other songs without having to be the front guy, without having to take the big solo. He can do that, you know, hang back and add some color.
Right.
The question is he going to be satisfied to do that for any length of time? And I'm not sure. I mean, like Nils, he could go up and take those flaming solos anytime, but he's also very content to hang back and add some texture in the background.
Right.
You know, he's more of a band guy.
There is kind of like that mindset that I wonder with Nils. You know, on the one hand, he is, you know, he does have his own career outside of this, and he has, you know, he can mount tours and play to pretty decent crowds, or he can just hang back and make a lot more money than he ever does, and which also funds his solo stuff, to be frank.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if Morello feels the same way.
I wonder.
Because I agree with Morello on a lot of things politically, but I don't think he's a particularly good songwriter of that type of material. Good politics do not always equal good songs, which is what I wrote in my review of Wrecking Ball.
I don't see him as someone that can hang back for very long. I mean, Morello definitely enjoys the spotlight.
And he did say about his upcoming solo album that he compare himself to Hendrix or say something like it's going to be the Jimi Hendrix for now or something that wasn't exactly a guy who stands back in the background would say.
Well, he and Bruce may have some of that ego wrestling with one's ego in common. May be able to bond on that level. But I'll be real interested, I think, to hear Morello's next album, to hear what he learns from touring with the E Street Band. I mean, if you don't learn something. I think we've seen that with Jake. He's learned a ton from his time with the band that he's bringing now to his solo work. And I'll be real interested to hear what Morello learns on the road and where this next album goes.
Yeah, and I guess Jake having to learn how to play in a section as opposed to just being the horn player. I don't know enough about Jake's career to know how it was before that.
Well, horn was not his primary. I mean, he was primarily a guitarist, singer-songwriter type.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, the sax, he played, but not that was not his primary instrument.
Okay.
And his EP is good. It surprised me.
It is. It's quite good. And he's done a few, well, I don't know if you guys saw him on Leno the other night.
I still haven't DVR'd. Haven't gotten to it.
It's really kind of funny to watch him and pick up, oh, he learned that move from watching Bruce. He has learned how to be a front man from watching the best front man in the world. Very interesting. But that's all kind of straying from the topic at hand of high hopes.
So I guess the question, you know, I think, you know, given your druthers, would you like to see Bruce put out an album every year? You know, with weird sort of, you know, going down weird side alleyways and old stuff that didn't quite fit and, you know, and occasionally a focused, you know, thematic album, or would you prefer he take a couple of years off and, you know, really work on that next, you know, masterpiece?
I'm fine with him revisiting his older work as much as possible, just because it's new to us. However, I would rather not have tracks that are already partially completed. Because you have a situation now where you have a whole bunch of tracks that were in part produced by Brendan O'Brien, who has his sensibilities, which, okay, we don't really we wore off quickly off of Brendan O'Brien's sensibilities, and now and Ron Aniello is putting his sensibilities on top of that, and we're kind of worn thin off of Ron Aniello's sensibilities. you know, I'd rather him go through his notebooks and say, "Oh yeah, this is a good song. We've never done this, and let's see what we can do with this now," rather than try to keep on building and trying to tinker with these things that already exist, and it just kind of winds up sounding like a mishmash.
That's a good point.
To me, I think one of the most fun parts of being a Springsteen fan is having all this access to his writing process and editing process over the years, and seeing the changes he's made, and seeing what he's chosen to include and what he's chosen not to. So I'd kind of love to have that combination of both of those albums that he's really worked on and perfected, and maybe, like I think a lot of people have suggested, something like High Hopes as a bonus disc, or something that's not as heavily marketed, because emotionally that's tougher to handle when I expect something different from what that turned out to be.
But did it bother you when you heard the news that this was outtakes mostly?
No.
And, you know, I have no problem with the covers either, because they're not, I mean, it's not like he's putting out Quarter to Three or, you know, some Stones song that we all know. I mean, they're more obscure songs.
Right.
So I think that's different, kind of a different use of, it's like when he put out Trapped. I mean, that's a cover. Yeah, yeah. But it's also very much him.
Yeah, it's a completely, Trapped is, when I heard the Jimmy Cliff version, I was like, this is an entirely different song. Mm-hmm. Bruce stripped out certain things of it. He stripped out a B minor chord in there. it's funny because Anne gets it.
Geek.
Not a geek. I'm a songwriter. when I heard Cliff, I was like, wait a second. You know, this is weird. I actually now prefer the Jimmy Cliff version, because Bruce took out the line, "Evil concentrated must be disintegrated," which is such a fucking gorgeous line. and in Jimmy Cliff's voice, it's, oh God, I love it.
Have you heard the Tom Waits Jersey Girl?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
The Horzette on the Avenue, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, like, you know, when Tom Waits sings it, it the whole thing strikes me as sarcastic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when Bruce sings it, it's so darn sincere. He does love that Jersey Girl.
Bruce doesn't do sarcastic. But again, you know, it's a different song, and I think that's what he's done with the covers on this album, is he's really made them his, and they're not songs that you've heard on the radio 10 billion times.
Right, he's not doing like Rod Stewart sings Motown covers. Sorry, Deb.
Yeah, we know you love him.
I just happened to have heard that album yesterday in a place where I was yesterday, and
so sorry.
Were you in hell?
I was actually in a very good pizza place, but they have a habit of playing his songbook albums. I'm like, oh God.
Stuff breadsticks in your ears, you'll be fine.
Well, I was watching the football game at the time, so. 500 miles I've gone today. Tomorrow's 500 more. Outside my window, the world passes by. It's stranger than a dream. Just like firewood, I'm burning. Just like so I think that one of the last things, we were talking about a little bit about it before, and that's Ron Aniello's production. And this is one of the things and one of the issues that I have kind of had with Bruce. You know, we and you were talking about how you like how Just Like Firewood and High Hopes just sound like the band live. And but I think that Bruce, and he said this in the Rolling Stone interview, that he wants to sound modern. You know, he had problems in the 90s when they made records, you know, like the Human Touch and Lucky, you know, Human Touch sounds like it could have been 1984. you know, Born in the USA was a very modern sounding record. It is just not, does not age well sonically in a lot of places. But I don't think he trusts his instincts because he still wants Phil Spector and Motown. You know, so we get somebody like Aniello, who has an understanding of drum loops and samples and vocal treatments. He knows how to do all those studio trickery, and he just sends Bruce, this is just my perception, and he sends Bruce the mixes, and Bruce goes, oh, this is how I, this is how my voice sounds like, and my songs sound like that. And he doesn't really know what works well and what doesn't work well.
I mean, it's so hard to, I know so little about what goes into producing a record, it's hard for me to say. But you see some of these other guys, like a Rick Rubin, you know, who deals with such, you know, different kinds of artists at all stages of their careers, and somehow always seems to make them sound good. And you wonder, you know, well, why isn't he looking for somebody like that? You know, but who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, Rubin says, because Rubin says, I want to strip you down to the essence of your best work, you know, of what made your records great. He knew that, he understood that Johnny Cash, the essence was the voice.
Right.
With Black Sabbath, he knew that it was getting, you know, a very specific sound out of them. And it was more about just like getting back to the heavy riffs and so on. But those may sound like modern, like the Black Sabbath record may sound modern in that it's digitally recorded and pro-tooled or whatever, but Bruce wants something that is, that doesn't sound like Born to Run or Darkness on the Edge of Town. And that bothers me because, well, Born to Run doesn't really necessarily have a really live sound, but Darkness does, The River does, Born in the USA, largely does. And it's like, you know, you keep on talking about how great your band is. You praise them at every opportunity. Understand that and unleash them. Let them play together. That is what they do best. And that just kind of bothers me when I hear this record.
Speaking of production, I read somebody, and I can't remember who or where, but somebody suggesting that Bruce should work with T-Bone Burnett or Buddy Miller, one of those Americana kind of rootsy guys. And my initial reaction was, no, 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 that's, you know, that's not who Bruce is, that he needs to work with a rock guy. And then I thought, you know, those are, they're songwriters. They're band leaders, and those are Bruce's strengths. The songwriting, I mean, you need to produce a song so that it showcases the song. You don't want to cover up the brilliant songwriting, and you want to showcase the band as well. So, I don't know, maybe one of those guys would be interesting for him to work with.
I think Burnett, the most of the Burnett records that I've heard that aren't Coen Brothers soundtracks in recent years have really choked the life out of a lot of those records. A lot of, you know, I loved what he did in the 90s with Elvis Costello and Sam Phillips, you know, just like a really good mixture of, you know, like the vintage keyboards and, you know, still like that really good open drum sound. But like that Robert Plant and Alison Krauss record, you know, I just thought it was stifled. Mm. But Buddy Miller, oh God, when you said his name, I was like, oh wow, that would be so good.
It would be interesting. It would be different.
Or you know who else? Jason Isbell. Get a young songwriter in there who knows his shit, who's also done some production work, now that you mention it. Yeah. But definitely a songwriter. You know, work, have Steve produce it again.
Well, yeah. Because Steve doesn't have anything else to do.
Right.
In his spare time.
His copious spare time.
I don't think Steve could work that. Like the first thing, get John out of here. get John out of here. It's like, I can't work with this guy anymore.
I would dearly love to see Steve produce it. I don't think it's going to happen because he's just got so many irons in the fire, but,
right.
But man, that would be fun.
Cause I think I've told Deb this, but not the two of you. When I hear The River, that album to me is the ultimate expression of Bruce and Steve's friendship.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I love that record so much. Mm-hmm.
Well, Steve understands what Bruce is trying to do better than anybody, and he can also say no.
Right.
In a way that other people, I mean, yeah, because I hang around and watch them all work all the time. Right, I know everything about them.
Well, you know, they like the same music, they like the same band.
They wear the same clothes, yeah. That's a good point.
But, you know, I see Steve as being very much not a yes man to Bruce. You know, I mean, to the point where he left the band at one point because he wanted to do something else. And,
right.
You know, and I think that would be really good. Won't happen. We can dream.
We'll mount a Twitter campaign.
Well, I should do it considering I got Tom Morello to play at Wrigley.
Yeah, that was a coup.
Good job.
He didn't even acknowledge me once during that.
But we can all daydream about who we would like to produce Spruce and who we'd like to see him play with. And in the end, we've got the album that we've got, you know, mm-hmm. and the shows that hopefully we will have. And if the album that we're listening to makes us daydream about the album that we wish it was, that kind of says something.
I mean, as much if I really wanted to dig in and criticize, and I can, as much as I can do that, I find myself with a lot of these songs caught in my head, though. And
oh, yeah.
Choruses just bouncing around in there at moments when I least expect it. And that says something, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I keep putting the thing on. I mean, I think I've listened to it pretty much every day since I first got a hold of it. And at least once a day. So I'm definitely not tired of it, and I'm definitely still hearing new things, and I really want to hear these songs live.
Yeah. Now this is your sword, this is your shield, this is the power of love and feel. Carry it with you wherever you go, and give all the love that you have in your soul.
What did y'all think of 41 Shots? I mean, it was only played a couple of times on this last tour, you know, right around the time of the Trayvon Martin verdict, and it didn't, you know, so it was a little strange to see this on the album because it wasn't, I don't want to say it wasn't relevant because it's still a relevant song, but it's had, 13 years now? It was debuted in 2000, so mid-2000s, so 13 and a half years. Was that a superfluous song to have on the record, even if it is a true studio arrangement and a song that lyrically is still, unfortunately, still relevant?
It's definitely for me, I answered your poll to Pete, and for me, that's probably my most skipped song.
Yeah, I mean, like I said in something I'd written, it's, if you were hearing it for the first time, I think it's one of his best. I love it. It's a terrific piece of work, but I don't feel like this adds that much to what we already know. So mm-hmm. it does become, you know, and Morello's guitar is very good on it, and you know, it's a good version, but it's maybe I you know, if I was more aware of, you know, some of the musical nuances, I'd appreciate it more, but I feel like mm-hmm. I knew that song, you know, backwards and forwards, and this, you know, was basically the same thing I already knew. So yeah, I think it is a little superfluous. I feel like it's there to lend it the authority of being on an album, to borrow Bruce's term, and not much else. Other than, you know, like you said, David, it's relevant to recent news events, you know, so maybe he does want to sort of point out that, hey, 13 years has gone by and we're still in the same place. So I guess it, maybe if you look at it that way, you know, it's justified, but...
That's an interesting point.
Maybe he did it as an excuse to keep on performing the song.
That's what I was thinking, is that he's asserting its relevance, but does he assert his relevance by continuing to perform it? Does he need to put it on the album to keep performing it?
Because I think if he puts it on the album, he's saying, yes, it's still relevant, it's still important. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, if he just does it at a concert here and then, you know, if he just puts it in sets, like, all right, why is this in the set? But if you put it on the album, you're making the statement that it's still relevant to the person who's coming to the show and can therefore expect to possibly hear it.
That's true, because when he played it this most recent round of times, it was like, oh, this is because of Trayvon Martin, you know?
Right.
And I think...
He said it, so he introed it that way, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think what he's saying is, well, this is because of... This is the way the world is.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't think the new version adds anything to what we already had. In fact, I think I prefer the earlier live version.
I do as well.
Clarence on it. I think it's a brilliant song.
I do too. Yeah. I do too. And that was one of the things that I wrote in my review, that on the other one, you had everybody opening up with a different, you know, each, you know, Clarence mm-hmm. and Patty and Steve and Nils all saying 41 Shots. And, you know, that's like so many different voices, you know, it's our collective outrage right there. And here it's Bruce's background vocals. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just Bruce saying it.
And I don't like the guitar on it.
The wah-wah pedal on there?
I just think it sounds... It sounds like an 80s action romance. You know? The guy's about to, you know, become the hero and get the girl, and I just... It just doesn't work for me.
I mean, that's what a lot of people said about Harry's Place, that it's cheesy and...
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I actually like the song, but I don't take it as seriously as Bruce does. In the Sirius XM interview, he talked about how it was about the Bush administration, and I was like,
yeah, I think
what?
He's wrong.
He said that about Outlaw Pete, too. He said the exact same thing about Outlaw Pete, and I didn't hear it there either.
I don't think he remembers when he wrote it. We all know he wrote it in 2001. And in fact, I think in the full transcript of the Rolling Stone interview, he says, yeah, I wrote that about the Bush years, and Andy Green said... Yeah, but you read the lyrics to Ted Koppel in 2001, and he said, oh, I must have written it then. You know, it's like, I don't know what I'm talking about here.
Unless he went back to it and added a few more things to it.
Right, and I think that's where he went with it eventually. But
yeah, I still don't hear that, the political bigger... I hear it as a story song. I hear it as a character song. I don't hear it as a larger statement. And it's okay not to make a bigger statement. To me, you know, I kind of like the song. I see it as kind of a throwaway, but
I hear it and I just picture Tony Soprano, and especially if you think of, okay, you know, he was writing this around 2001, you know, Steve was, you know, doing Silvio, and he was just thinking of the Sopranos and just kind of, you know, it was like, all right, that I can write that theme a lot better than A3.
And here's a character that would be fun to play with and jump into this voice and, you know, embody right. this character for 3.5 minutes.
And say fuck 3 times in a song.
I was just going to say, after Queen of the Supermarket, it was just out there.
Yeah.
Harry's Place is the number one most skipped song, according to our poll. It's incidentally, by a fairly wide margin. 14% to 11, which is Heaven's Wall, was second. Now, I was going to say, the number one choice is None. I skip None. I love or at least like them all.
I wonder how many of those people are skipping it because they have kids.
I don't like them all, but I do skip... I don't skip over anything when I'm listening to an album straight through.
Not the first few times, but eventually.
If I'm making a conscious effort to listen to an album, I'm going to listen to it all the way through. Otherwise, right. I'll just put stuff on shuffle.
Right.
Yeah, I've thrown this album into shuffle just to see how the tracks go in relation to other random songs that pop up. And that's been kind of interesting. I didn't do that the first, you know, dozen or so times I listened to the album, but then I threw it in.
And incidentally, if you just play all the up-tempo songs, it works well as a workout tape.
Well, there you go.
I found that out. Heaven's Wall. There you go. Raise your hand.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm picturing you doing jumping
yeah,
jacks
don't,
now.
Don't. It was all a favor and don't.
And that's going to do it for this special Bruce Springsteen High Hopes themed podcast. Pete, Dim, and Ann, thank you for joining me today. And we will have a link to their site, Blogness on the Edge of Town, in the show notes for today's episode. Go over to popdose.com for all the latest in pop culture news. And go to iTunes. Download our various podcasts. We don't do a lot of them, but when we do, they're pretty damn good. And while you're there, leave a positive review because, you know, maybe it'll give us an incentive to do more of these. Who knows? We certainly don't. And take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Pop Dose audience.
Raise your hand.